Last week, I spoke on the providence of God. Demonstrated, I trust, that God has a providential government. That all things do work together for good to those who do love God and are called according to His purpose. And that God is working to fulfill His purpose, and His acts have different effects upon people in different conditions and in different states. To those who love Him, all things are being worked together for their good. To those who do not love Him, all things are working for their ruin. And we went through that last week. Now, the providence of God is one of the portions of God's government. God governs in one manner through His providence. He has a government, a physical government, whereby He governs over all things under physical law. All created things are under physical law. The stone obeys physical law. God governs the whole created universe by giving laws to everything that is physical, and they are beings that act involuntarily, subject to physical laws, and can do no other. He has also creatures that He has created that are moral agents that have the ability to say no to the law that God would require of them. And therefore they can disobey that law, and that's the moral law. Two creatures who are moral agents and have the ability to say no, God's purposes are not thwarted because they say no. But He does, in fact, continue to administer His government in physical matters as well as moral matters through His providence. And so His providential government is still bringing about His purposes, whether people who are moral agents cooperate with that or not. It is a beautiful system. Today I'm going to speak specifically about God's moral government, and it has to do with, we will see, also human government. It has to do with church and its government, and it has to do with the family and its government. Next week, I trust it is the will of the Lord that we shall talk about family government. It is appropriate on Father's Day, and it is in conjunction with the teaching that I'm giving on God's government. And the following Sunday, Lord willing, I will be speaking on the church government, and try to articulate how that applies to the church and how it applies to the family. Much of this is, to some of you, a review. To many of you, it is first time that you've heard some of these truths. Some of you, you've heard various things, and this will, I trust, pull things together for your understanding and give you a basis upon which to understand a lot of the things that I've been teaching. This is going to be called God's moral government. Now, moral government is a truth. It's not a theological view. It is a truth. If moral government exists, it is applicable to all moral agents, whether you're Buddhist or Hindu, Catholic or Protestant. Moral government is not a religious matter. It belongs to nobody's religion. It is overall and is imposed upon all moral agents. So for someone to stand up and declare the necessity for man to love God with all of his heart, mind, soul, and strength, to love his neighbor as himself, is not to speak a Christian doctrine, but is to proclaim a law that exists where there are no formal theological views at all. It is a universal truth. It is a universal law. Now, in God's moral government, in any moral government, you have to have, and we do have in God's moral government, a governor. God is clearly the king of the universe. His majesty is proclaimed in His universe. And the verse we read here in Psalms talks about that would be made known to the sons of men thy mighty acts and the glory of the majesty of thy kingdom. Thy kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and thy dominion endures throughout all generations. The Bible clearly shows throughout so many passages that there is a kingdom that God is king over. You might infer that the fact that God is a king, that he would have a kingdom, and that would be a true inference. But the Bible is not that vague. The Bible clearly reveals that there is a kingdom. Jesus prayed and taught us to pray, "Thy kingdom come, and thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So God is a king, a governor. By governor, I do not mean that he is less than king, but in his authority and in his function, in his moral government, he governs. Therefore, he is a governor. In a kingdom, in a government, there is also law. You cannot have a government or a kingdom without law. There is necessarily law, and God has revealed his law. It is spoken and revealed through the law of Moses. But that law, as we shall see, is universally known. For there to be a government properly, law is given. We'll look at the nature of law in a few moments. And it also has rewards and punishments. Rewards for conformity to that law, and punishments for disconformity or transgression of the law. Something else that's not often taken into account regarding God's government as a moral governor, governor of the universe, and that is, when there is a governor, there is to be governees. There is no such thing as a governor without a governee. If you have nothing to govern, you're not a governor. Lucy made a very funny joke one time, as I recall a long time ago, where Ricky was saying to her, long time ago, on the honeymoon, Jackie Gleason was saying to his wife on the program, "I am the boss and you are nothing. I am the boss and you are nothing." And he kept raising his voice and being more emphatic, as you might imagine how he was if you've ever seen him, until his whole body was shaking with the emphasis of, "I am the boss and you are nothing." And then she simply quipped, "That's right, you're boss over nothing." Okay. So if a person believes that they're the boss or they're the governor, but if there's no one to govern, then they're not governors. They're governor over nothing, and therefore they're not governors. I am not a parent. I cannot pretend to be a parent. I cannot act as though I'm a parent. I cannot say to people, I am a parent, because I have no children. Without children, nobody is a parent. Children create parents. In a sense, the arrival of children create the relationship of a parent, and not before that. So too, when there is a governor, there are governees. In the responsibility to govern in God's government, there is implied the responsibility of those he governs to be governed. Just as in a schoolroom situation where if there is a teacher, it implies by the very nature of the fact that those who are sitting there must be willing to be taught for the teacher to teach. Same is true in church. We'll deal with that when we get to church government, government of church. Government is... Government is the administration of law. That's what government is. It is the control of moral agents through law. That's the definition of government. It is the administration of law. It could be physical government, but in moral government, it is the control of moral agents through law, or the administration of moral law over moral agents. Now, government is not politics. Government is not politics. I think that is generally confused in most people's thinking. We had a primary election last Tuesday. We did not vote on our government. We voted on politicians. Our government is not going to change because we will change perhaps a governor, perhaps a president, perhaps senators. If they are voted out and new ones are voted in, our government will not change. but the people who have the power of government will. Politics is the struggle for power to use the power of government. It is the struggle between individuals to gain that power, whatever means that is. That's politics. That can happen in church, it can happen in families, where there's this power struggle, conflict, seeing who's going to rise to the top and have the supreme power. That's politics. That is not government. We have a government in the United States of America, and it is constituted a particular way. We have an executive branch, we have a judicial branch, we have a legislative branch. That is how it is constituted. It is constituted to function a certain way for the purpose of administering law. That is our government. We have had various politicians who have not honored that government, nor upheld it very well, nor used its strength for its ultimate purpose of good for the people. But that does not necessarily mean that government itself is evil, because evil men have used government for their own ends. Sadly, in our time, as the honor and respect due to government and its offices is diminishing and diminishing, and people are being elected who are less and less respectful and worthy of respect, the public mind, I believe, is confusing the difference between the people who are in government and government itself. And on popular talk shows and things, what is often attacked is government. We need a change of government, people might say, when they really mean we need a change of people who have the power of government. So make a distinction in your mind between politics and government. Very different things. Politics needs to be cleaned up. Government needs to be properly run. Two different things. How does God govern His moral government? What means does He use, is what I'm asking. Does God sit on His throne and send multitudes of multitudes times multitudes of angels to individuals, and almost like a puppet show, is orchestrating everything that happens, so that any moment given in time He is governing through immediate, direct, individual relationships? Is that how He's governing? Sometimes that picture may appear in some people's thinking. That picture may be given to people by way, the way in which perhaps ministers present the idea, or we get the notion from it by the way we conceive of something. God administers and governs His moral government through, number one, His own throne, through His providence, we talked about last week. Number two, through the moral law and the administration of it. Number three, through human government. Number four, through church government. And number five, through family government. Now, doesn't that sound rather unspiritual? Doesn't it, though? That God is, in fact, governing and securing His purposes and administering His kingdom through human government. The day in and day out wheels of government that grind so slow. Does that mean that God is using to govern His kingdom and moral agents? Is the family really a means that God has appointed and actively uses and ordained to govern and administer His law? Is that true for the church as well? Indeed it is true. And I'll show you that in just a few moments. To answer a couple more questions. Why is there moral government? Why has God established a government with laws, with rewards, and with punishments? Why does he do that? Why didn't he just create moral beings and deal with them individually? And why did he establish a moral government? Why did he establish government at all? Why is the family government, church government, human government? Why did he establish those? And I think the usual answer and response when people think about human governments or family governments is God has ordained government and these forms of government because of the wickedness of people. They need to be constrained. They need law to suppress their violence and their wickedness. They need to be drawn in. They need to be punished because they're wicked. And that's why God has ordained government and his own government. But that is not why God has ordained it. He has ordained government through the administration of law because it is the highest and best means of promoting the greatest good and well-being of you and I, moral agents. Government is an expedient means to promote the greatest good in the universe. Take physical government. By imposing upon all these physical inanimate objects a law to perform a certain way, always obey the laws given to them, it creates the opportunity for the greatest amount of good to be done because we can depend upon the sun to appear at certain times in the morning and to descend at certain times at night. Every day we can depend upon it. We plan, we can depend upon it. We base the development and the production of good upon these laws always being there. We are certain that we can take off from Orange County and land in San Francisco and that the laws of aerodynamics are not just going to be set aside that day. And all the good things that man has developed by discovering, simply discovering, not inventing, but discovering the laws that God has put in inanimate things is a great source of good for mankind. And same is true with the moral law. When the moral law is understood and adhered to, it creates the greatest, highest possible good in God's kingdom for all concerned. But is it necessary because people are wicked? No. Human government, moral government, is necessary because of ignorance. Ignorance, not wickedness. There is a kingdom. God has a government in heaven where there are no wicked people. But the government of God and his law is still in operation in heaven. It will be there for everyone who goes there, who have been redeemed. You will see, if you go there, the most beautiful thing, the administration of the moral law, and the adherence to it of everyone that is there. You will see such a state of blessedness. You will see individuals all seeking the good of another. And you will be doing that too. And you'll be surrounded with multitudes of people all seeking your good. Marvelous. Beautiful. Be surrounded with people that you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, their intent is only for your good. You will not ever question. You will have perfect confidence that everything that people do is for your good. They intend your good. You will be busy, though, seeking their good. So you really won't concern yourself if you're getting enough or whatever. You'll be just so thankful for whatever good is done to you. But you'll be more thankful that you have an opportunity without obstacles to promote good. Total liberty to promote good. Day after day. Throughout the night because there is no night. 24 hours, a millennium. There's ongoing opportunity to promote good. The reins will be pulled off. The restraints will be pulled off. And there in heaven, people can, without reservation, run and excel and proceed in working with God to promoting good. There'll be much to do throughout eternity. It's not a place to go and then flop down and rest and, boy, I've just made it. I need a millennium of rest here. No. It's just it's just pulling aside the restraints of this body and this world and temptation and just going on full speed with God, seeking to do good, promoting good. My. That's marvelous to contemplate. But here's where we learn to do that. You don't learn to do that after you get to heaven. You are prepared and taught and begin to do that here. Seeking good for another for its own sake. Totally disinterested. But it is ignorance that necessitates government. Government is designed to promote the greatest good. That's its purpose. But why is it necessary? Because of the ignorance of moral beings. Now, in any given society, any given group, small group, this size of group, even in a small group this size, even after hearing some teaching for some time, no two of you would hold the same views on any, in all subjects. No two of you have the same level of development of understanding of truth. None of us would have exactly the same understanding of moral government, moral law, truth, the atonement, what our obligations and responsibilities are. It is the differential in understanding, the differential in the level of knowledge and understanding that creates the possibility of conflict, disagreement, trouble, temptation, and possibly sin. Just the differential in understanding and knowledge creates the possibility of conflict. Government is the means God uses to avoid conflict, to avoid the differences in understanding causing a conflict. Now, you know in the home, that's exactly what one of your responsibilities are as parents, is to use your reason and your wisdom, which I trust is superior to your children's, and give them direction on how to live their lives. And as different ones progress at different levels, because of age differences and maturity and all of that, you're going to have one saying, I think this is the way it ought to be, another one saying, I think this is the way it ought to be, and you have to say, no, this is the way it has to be. Or no, you have to give in to your brother, or you have to settle those things. Now, it's not just a matter of settling conflicts, but the wonderful truth of moral government is that it sets down the moral law, which, when adhered to, does not let conflicts arise. It actually avoids them ahead of time rather than settling them after the fact. It's a marvelous, marvelous thing. But it is the ignorance of people. By that I don't mean people are stupid or that they don't know anything. But it is the differential in what people know that requires a government and the means of government to keep that from becoming a means of conflict, temptation, or sin. So that would therefore impose upon a government to inform, educate those that it governs, to inform them of their nature, of their responsibilities, of the moral law and what's required of them. To inform them by telling them when they're able and old enough to understand telling. To inform them through example from the day that they are born. Speaking of children, they gain the idea of what is important through your example before they ever understand the words that would describe the idea. Before children can speak, you have greatly educated them and developed ideas before they even know what words would identify those ideas. Now, one of the purposes of the governors is then to teach and bring up the level of understanding higher and higher of an understanding of the moral law. For what purpose? Well, if everybody has its different levels of understanding and knowledge, and somebody is the governor, the parent, the pastor, the governor, the president, and you say that this government is established to avoid conflicts and settle them ahead of time, why do I need to be educated? Why do I need to learn? Excuse me. Because the aim of government, what it is aiming for is to produce a moral agent that is self-governing. The aim of moral government is to secure the self-government of a moral agent. He is to be informed of his responsibilities, of the penalties and the rewards of obedience. He is to be trained to adhere to that moral law, to function in a moral government, so that at some point in time, he has a sufficient knowledge of moral law and moral obligation and moral government, and has developed the willingness to govern himself according to that law. Now, self-government does not mean that you turn a person loose and they can do whatever they want. We're not talking about self-determination. That is, a person turns 18, they're turned loose and they have a right to do whatever they want. No, they don't. They have an obligation to love God and love their neighbor. And the responsibility of those who have the responsibility of governing is to bring those individuals to an understanding of their responsibility and bring about a willingness to adhere to those responsibilities so that they become self-governing and actually live by the moral law by self-control, self-government. They adapt their reason and understanding to impose upon themselves the moral law, and they submit to it and their willingness to live by it. That is a self-governed moral agent. That person can go anywhere in the world, in any relationships they enter into, and will live by the moral law. They will be people of integrity. It will be people that will honor authority and, if necessary, exercise authority. Those are people that could be trusted, who self-govern themselves according to the moral law, but not through force, not through intimidation, not through threats, not through hypocrisy by pretending to for some ulterior motive, but from the heart have been brought to love God with all their heart, love their neighbor as themselves, and live that way, whether anybody's watching them or not. That is the aim of self-government, or moral government. That's what it's aiming for. But moral government always starts out with people who don't know. And so there must be this function of moral government to inform them of their obligation. Now, children must be informed by example, by training, that there is a law imposed upon them, just like there is a law imposed upon the parent who is over them. And they must be shown that and taught that from the very beginning. That there is a law above us all, the moral law. That law is a good law. that government is a good government, and that this household must be run by that moral law, a law of love, and every child must be taught to respect that and to apply it to himself, and the parent is to administer that. Let's look at human government. Turn to Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. A lot of people are a little bit edgy about human government, especially on April 15th. Just that authority, that final authority, you get to April 14th, but when you get to April 15th, midnight, the authority of our government and you and I meet head on, don't we? Face to face. Yeah, I mean, it's every year, like no other day. April 15th is an extension of the authority of our government right into the deepest part of it, money. And what you feel on that day and how you look at that day says something about yourself, about ourselves. That's a day when people can get a little fidgety, a little resentful, things like that. Romans chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it, authority, is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Is that clear? Is that clear? God is speaking and authorizing and sanctioning human government. That human government and human authority is a minister of God for good. It is God's appointed means. Paying taxes is a responsibility for all to do. Because government is legitimate. Human government is legitimate. It is with the sanction of God. Now, some people might read this and say, well, I don't think Bill Clinton was elected by God, and try to make this verse apply to specific individuals at particular times. I can't see that he's a servant of God, so I don't think I'm going to obey him. It is not Bill Clinton that is at issue. It is government. Bill Clinton simply has the reins of government at the moment. But it is government and its functioning that God sanctions. There's a big difference. If there were no government, my friends, you would have a great deal to fear. Look at Somalia as a perfect example. Look at Rwanda. There is no government in Rwanda. And hatred and bitterness and selfishness is without control. Because there's no governing force, no governing power. No government. Same in Somalia, when we went over there and sent troops over. People were starving to death. There's anarchy in the streets throughout the country because there was no government that had authority to bring these things into alignment and to rule for the good of the people. Famous line by Thomas More. Thomas More, the man for all seasons, who would not approve of the marriage of Henry VIII to a second wife, and would not approve of the divorce from his first wife. And they put him in prison, they threatened him, and they said, "Oh, with the law you are threatened, Thomas More." He says, "If I'm threatened by the law, then I'm not threatened. Because the law is a great protector of those who do good." Now, given there have been people in governmental positions who have wreaked great harm, but it is not government that does that. People like Hitler, truly wicked, not a servant of God, but he perverted government. He perverted government, used it for his own ends rather than for the ends it was designed. Does a Christian under a government that becomes perverted and commands people to sin and uses his government as instruments to sin, is a Christian under moral obligation to obey that government? No, he's not. Governments are legitimate and are generally drawn up according to the moral law, because every man understands concepts of moral law. God has built that into every man. But if a government establishes law contrary to moral law as its governing principles, no Christian is under obligation. In fact, a Christian is under obligation to see that it changes. But until that becomes clear cut, as long as we don't separate the distinction, as long as we keep the separation of distinction between the person governing and the government, then we must uphold government because it is appointed by God. Even when it becomes questionable, the principle is to uphold government, because upholding government until it becomes clear that it is immoral is more important than the chaos that ensues when governments are overthrown. So it would be a very careful thing to do to resist government. You must have clear knowledge and understanding of what is involved there. But by and large, the point that the scriptures are making is God has appointed human government as his servants to administer moral law. Turn to Daniel. Book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. Question. Jesus was tempted by the devil. One of the temptations was, the devil said, "Bow down before me, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world." Took Jesus up on a pinnacle and showed him, the Bible says, all the kingdoms of the world by some means. Show him all these kingdoms. He said, "Bow down to me, and I'll give you all these kingdoms." Does the devil rule the kingdoms of the world? Are the kingdoms of this world, or the governments of this world, ruled by the devil? Does he have control of them? Well, it wouldn't seem so from Romans 13, would it? That's a misconception by some Christian people in their thinking, that the governments of this world are run by the devil, and they are usually, in their thinking, willing to disobey general laws for the public good, because they hold that human governments are from the devil, or controlled by the devil. Let's look at Daniel chapter 4. King Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, a big tall tree, beautiful big tall tree, wonderful fruit, leaves, beauty. And then he had a dream of a watcher, an angel, coming down and said, "Chop down the tree and cut off its branches and strip it bare and leave the stump on the ground," and all of that. And he was bothered by that dream. So So he called Daniel to himself and said, Daniel, I've had this terrible dream. Would you please explain it to me? Beginning with verse 19. Then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him. The king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you, and its interpretation to your adversaries. The tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, whose height reached to the sky and was visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the sky lodged, it is you, O king. For you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And in that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, Chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts of the field until 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. God was judging Nebuchadnezzar for believing he was the highest authority anywhere. That his kingdom was through his doing. It was solely his and had no authority over him. And God was bringing him down to recognize something. And Daniel reveals that he will be driven like an animal into the field, which he was for 7 years. His hair grew like a beast. He lost his ability to think straight. He acted like an animal for 7 years. And then God restored his mind. And the purpose of it was to teach him what? That you will be assured after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Human governments are ordained by God. God is active in who governs. It is not purely human activity that is behind who governs. Well, after his occasion and after his experience, verse 34, Nebuchadnezzar regains his senses, regains his kingdom, and gets a true perspective of where his authority comes from and says, And I bless the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. But he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, What hast thou done? God is actively involved in human government. And no one rises to the top of human government contrary without the consent of God. And that's what Daniel was telling Nebuchadnezzar he had to learn. How do you explain Hitler? How do you explain that? Is God love? Why would he consent to a Hitler to gain power? Because in the principles of moral government, sometimes one must be permitted to be punished so that the government itself sustains its authority, respect, and proper function. That is why the sinner must go to hell. The sinner goes to hell for the same reason the saint goes to heaven. The sinner goes to hell for the same reason the saint goes to heaven. Because that promotes the greatest good. It promotes the greatest good for the sinner to receive his punishment in order for the kingdom of God and the government of God to sustain itself. And why is that so important? Because his government is the means to produce the greatest good. To set aside governmental considerations for one person to keep them out of hell would be to set aside the means that produces the greatest good in the whole universe. I'd like to give you some considerations regarding moral government. Let me finish my thought on Hitler. Some people think that democracy is ordained of God. It's God's government. But if you looked at God's moral government in heaven, you would not find a democracy. It is not run by the majority of votes of the saints or of the angels. It is not a democracy. It is not. Democracy is not a divine institution. Democracy is one form of numerous forms of government. There's monarchy. There's dictatorship. There's limited monarchy. There's a republican form of government, not to be confused with the Republican Party, but a republic. And there is democracy. The United States was constituted as a republic. Not a democracy. Various forces and influences are moving the country to be a democracy. Everybody has a say on what happens rather than the representatives of our people. We were constituted a republic. No one form of government is ordained by God. Because depending upon the intelligence or the knowledge of a group of people and their virtue, they may need a very strong hand until their virtue and knowledge is raised and they are more able and willing to govern themselves and restrain themselves from transgressing the law. When a people have a raised level of virtue and a raised level of the knowledge of the will of God and are willing to conform to that, God will permit them, and it would be proper for them to have a form of government with less control from the top and more privileges and freedom for the people who are being governed. Our form of government was created with great freedom, self-governed, and they constituted a government that depended upon a people to be self-governed in order for it to work. And one of the problems or the crises of our time is we have a constituted form of government that depends upon the self-governing of the people, but we don't have a people that are self-governing. And we're in great crises over that. And our government is moving and changing because people don't govern themselves. And what's the evidence of that? Multitudes and multitudes of new laws every year trying to restrain the wickedness and the selfishness of the people. We are moving away from liberty, and in the name of liberty, we are moving towards great restraint by government. More and more restraint on how you are to live your life. Because people do not live their life by self-restraint, government is imposing it upon people. Even to the point of, if you commit a crime with hatred in your heart, it increases your punishment. That's what's happening. So, God will permit the more liberty to people who are more willing to constrain themselves, and He will, in fact, impose great constraints upon a people who do not constrain themselves because that is what is needed for their good. A Hitler rises to power. Why? Because it would demonstrate that that people and that nation is a wicked nation. And the only thing that could come out of that nation is a wicked person. And what happened to them? God judged that nation by permitting a man to rise who would come in conflict with other nations and be greatly subdued through the force of war to judge that people. And that's how oftentimes he does that. So it does not mean that God was absent in the middle of the century when there was a Second World War. It means that God's purposes are being carried out to judge a people that started the First World War and did a number of things in Europe that was not godly. Some considerations of moral government. Number one, it is never arbitrary. Moral government and its law and the governing of moral government is never arbitrary. What do I mean by arbitrary? An arbitrary decision or an arbitrary person who rules arbitrarily is one who simply makes decisions based upon no principle whatever except the impulses that move him at the moment. There's no reference to any overriding principle or truth that would guide his thinking and correct his judgment and determine his judgment, but it is a momentary impulse or desire or whim. That's what would be the law at the moment, and that's subject to change tomorrow, depending on the change of circumstances or the change of feelings or the change of impulse. That's an arbitrary individual. God does not rule arbitrarily. Some people define the sovereignty of God as the arbitrariness of God, that he is so sovereign he can do whatever he chooses to do. And today he can be benevolent, tomorrow he can be disbenevolent, and because he's God, it is all right. Both the benevolence and disbenevolence, it would be right because it is God doing it. But that's not true. God is not arbitrary. God runs and ministers everything according to his purpose. He has a purpose behind, and he references that purpose with everything that he does. His purpose is to promote the greatest good because he is benevolent. That's the purpose he has adopted and lives by. God is not arbitrary. He is so conformed to one purpose and principle. That is why you can trust him. If he was arbitrary, if he did not have one purpose that continually controlled his behavior and his actions and his ways, to which he was always conformed to, you'd have no sure reason to trust him. But because he says, I am God and I change not, demonstrates he's not arbitrary. And demonstrates why he can be trusted. And once you see a revelation of the character that he has, which he is always committed to have, then you have the basis upon which to place your trust in him. Secondly, moral government is always through confidence, never through force. Never through force. It is always through persuasion and drawing out of the person governed confidence in the person who governs. If you do not gain the confidence of one that you're responsible to govern, then you will have no true relationship of government. And you'll have no true submission or obedience. A friend of mine said once, command without relationship produces rebellion. And that is true. When there's no relationship between two people, and one has authority over another and responsibility over another, and they command them to do something, if there's no relationship, you'll get rebellion. Existence. Only when there's relationship. When a person has a relationship with God through Christ and they hear the commands of God, it doesn't instigate and generate rebellion because there's a relationship. And that relationship is faith in God. And once that is there, whatever commands one hears from God is not resistance. But without relationship, you can try to administer a moral government in your home or in church or in human government, and when you have no confidence in those who have the authority and responsibility to govern, then you'll find yourself resisting. That confidence may properly not be there because that person may, or the person responsible, may not be trustworthy, And we'll deal with that. There is to be confidence. If there is no confidence, you will not find effective moral government. It is always through persuasion. Moral government and God's moral government is administered solely through persuasion. He does not physically force anybody. By physical, I do not mean our material bodies. By physical force, I mean he comes down and makes us choose something. If he made us choose something, then we'd be subject to his physical government, not the moral government. It is only because we are free to resist all persuasion that we are moral beings. And how does he gain our submission to him, our obedience to him? By persuading us to yield. And that's true in homes, churches, whatever, human governments. It's through persuasion. If God crosses the line from persuasion to force, he is no longer administering moral government, but physical government. And when he crosses that line, if he were, he does not. If God were to cross the line from persuasion to force, that person would no longer be responsible for what he does, because he would not have chosen what God made him to do. So he could not be blamed for what he did, nor praised for what he did. His moral agency would be set aside. He would be just like a rock as far as responsibility goes. Another consideration of moral government, this is one of my favorites. The relationship of responsibility and authority. The relationship between responsibility and authority. Those who have authority to govern have the responsibility to govern correctly. Those who have the authority to govern, these will all be applied in our teaching on family government and church government. Those who have a responsibility to govern, those who have authority to govern have the responsibility to govern correctly. I love this relationship. This is marvelous. This is one of the most beautiful parts of the law and moral government that I have learned. If I have authority to do something, I have the responsibility to do it. If I have the responsibility to do something, I must have the authority to carry it out. Your husband tells you, you have the responsibility to make sure that children eat lunch. But then he says to you, but you're not to take any money and buy food for them to eat. By that statement, he has taken away the responsibility to feed the children, because he must also give you the authority to carry out the responsibility that has been put upon you. Same thing isn't true with employment. The gentleman is working, the boss comes up to you and says, you have the responsibility to get this out today by 5 o'clock. But you do not have the authority to command anybody to change their way of doing things. Or you come up to the secretary and says, you have the responsibility to keep stamps in this drawer, but you do not have the authority to take money out and go buy them. Same principle all the way down the line. So anytime somebody has the responsibility of something, they must have the authority to carry it out. And anytime somebody has authority due to their position appointed by God, then they also carry the load of responsibility that goes with that. They must administer the authority in a responsible way. Mr. Clinton has great authority. He has enormous responsibility. Mrs. Clinton has taken on great responsibility. She has no authority. When you get married, you take on great responsibility. You must also take on and know that you have authority to do that. Now, why I love this is that when you define, when you draw the lines, and when you draw the borders, and when you draw the perimeters of who's responsible for what, then you know who has authority to do what. And it's wonderful, because if I do not have a responsibility to do something and somebody were to come up to me and complain that you didn't do that, I can simply say that was not my responsibility. And that's the end of it. That is the end of it. If you do not have the responsibility for something, nobody can put that upon you and say, well, why didn't you do so-and-so? Well, it was not my responsibility. If somebody gives you the authority for something, then you have the responsibility to carry it out. If somebody gives you the responsibility for something, and you must be given the authority to carry it out. It's a marvelous principle. Now, if it's my responsibility to love God with all my heart, and it is, and to love you as myself, and it is my responsibility to do that, then I should be engaged in doing that. I should be engaged in doing that. And since that's my responsibility, then I have the authority to do that, which I do, and I exercise that. Now, if you have the responsibility to love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself, and that is your responsibility, then you have the authority to do so. God has given you the authority, the ability to do so. But this is the wonderful part. I'm not responsible for you loving God with all your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself. I can never feel guilty if you do not, because I'm not responsible for your failure to do so. I'm responsible to you to inform you of your responsibility, to inform you of the grace of God that will forgive your transgression, to inform you of the mercy of God that will keep the punishment from you that you deserve, to inform you of the conditions of faith and repentance to receive the grace and mercy of God. But I'm not responsible for you doing that. I'm responsible to you. But I'm not responsible for your refusal to do that. And neither can I take the praise if you do it. Because that's your responsibility to do it. And when you submit to God, I can't take the praise for that. That's what happened between you and God. And if you do not, I cannot take the blame for that, unless I have been very negligent in being responsible to you in the responsibilities as a pastor. Another marvelous thing of this truth is that I really am blessed by is my responsibility is to love God supremely and love you as I love myself, love my neighbor as myself, and that's my responsibility. And that takes up all my energy. And I love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And that's my responsibility. You know, truly, there is really no room left. There's no energy left. There's no mind left to sit around and figure out whether other people are doing that. To spend the energies of my mind on being judgmental and critical and censorious about others and examining their lives, watching for everything that they do externally and trying to figure out the motive behind it, is putting my mind upon things and drawing it away from using my mind and heart and strength to love God and love my neighbor. So, I fulfill my responsibilities, and we'll get this into more in church government, but as an example, I fulfill my responsibilities to you and to God, but the responsibility with what you do with the truth is yours. We live in a McDonald's world. We live in a drive-through world. Okay? You go to McDonald's, the world frame of reference is, this is the McDonald's world. What do I want today? Oh, let's go here, like McDonald's, we're going to treat it like McDonald's. Let's see, what have you got, what's your specials, and what do I want? I'll take one of these, and two of these, and supersize it, and off we go. Got what we want. Well, church is not like that. Church is not like McDonald's where you walk in and say, let's see what we got today, and what do I want? Well, I take a couple of verses of songs, and a couple of this, and listen to the prayer, and hear some of the message, see what I want out of the message, and off you go, and until you get hungry next time. No. If I fulfill my responsibility to God and to you to lay the truth out before you, it falls upon you the responsibility to take it, to think on it, to apply. Not treat it like just a trip through McDonald's that you got some good out of it and next week you get some more good out of it. Not that kind of thing at all. This responsibility and authority relationship is really wonderful because it just settles everything. Person comes home and says, why didn't you do that? Well, I thought you were going to do that. Well, I thought you were going to do that. And there's no clear understanding of who's responsible. Then you get the arguments. Then you get so many ramifications of that. But when responsibilities are drawn and you have both parties willing to do the responsibility, you remove 99% of all problems and reasons for problems. The only other difficulty would arise when there's not been a clear understanding or a difference in the level of knowledge. And sometimes you have to call in a third party to say, this is my understanding of it and this is my understanding of it. How should we approach it? And that's where a government over you would come in. So we have arbitrators in governments. When the union and management can't settle things, they're sent by the government to arbitration. So somebody over them makes a decision, and they both submit to that decision. They said about Jesus, we will not have this man to rule over us. There's no submission to God or his representative, because there was no submission to God's moral authority and government. We'll stop here and develop these thoughts next week. Next week we'll continue on the subject of family government. A means God has appointed to administer his moral government. Praise the Lord. Thank you, Father, for your great, great being, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. It is there. We cannot bring it down by unbelief or rebellion. It is there and you've established it. You administer it faithfully, continually. You've taken all of your attributes and you devote them to promoting good and uphold your kingdom and uphold its law, to uphold the very means of securing the greatest good. Lord, an understanding of your government and the moral law, an understanding of these things helps us to justify your actions and to see the intent and purpose of them. And Lord, an understanding of these things will give us reasons and basis upon which to construct our lives and relationships. Will give us reasons to see that the government that has been placed over us is a hand of yours, is an instrument of yours. We are not to resist its governing. We are to be submitted to it as it is a servant of you. That we are not to consider that the governments are run by the devil, for he is a liar from the beginning. But we are to consider that they are your means for our good. Lord, open up our understanding of this cause our minds to be stirred and look into these matters more fully. And Lord, for every heart that is willing to submit to your government and your law, there will be great peace, and great efficiency, and great good that can be accomplished. Lord, may we as a church, as a people, know that living according to your law and your government is how we should run our lives and our relationships here. Give us great wisdom in this matter, Father, I pray, for the good of all and for the good of your kingdom. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you, church. Thank you.